This is 2020-1498 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Hacker. Ms. McFaul, good morning.
Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. I'm Tina McFaul. I represent Christopher Hacker along with co-counsel Mark Triplett. I'd like to request 7 minutes for myself, and I would like to cede 5 minutes of my time to Stephen Hardwick of the State of Ohio Public Defender's Office and reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The indeterminate sentencing scheme provisions of Senate Bill 201 violate Christopher Hacker's state and federal constitutional rights by violating the separation of powers doctrine, denying him a right to a jury trial, and by denying him his due process rights.
Is that jury trial right even before us?
Yes.
How?
Didn't the third district say that it wasn't even raised?
In this case, it affects so many people in Ohio that it would be providential for you to hear the jury trial argument and make a decision on that.
Even though the trial court never had a chance?
Even though the trial court never had a chance.
Okay.
I mean,
and
it affects a lot of people, doesn't that seems to cut the other way, that all the reasons that we would want to not decide issues until lower courts have had a chance to review them would seem to apply even more forcefully here, where it's an important issue, it's going to affect a lot of people.
It's my position that you should review all of the constitutional challenges that can be raised at this time on their face for judicial economy and to provide those answers to all the defendants that have been sentenced under Senate Bill 201 thus far, and the people that have raised their rights and the people that have not.
Are all three facial challenges?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
The separation of powers doctrine is violated by Senate Bill 201 because it delegates the length of the sentence past the presumptive release date to the executive branch through DRC. DRC has unilateral control over whether or not the judge's presumptive release date will be granted or not.
Counsel, let me ask you, if the statute did not contain a presumptive release date, would there be any issue about separation of powers? If the scheme just simply provided, as it did prior to 1996, a range?
There would not be.
Thank you.
The purpose of the separation of powers doctrine is to ensure the powers that belong to one branch not be directly and completely administered by another branch, and to prevent one branch from having a direct or indirect overruling influence on another branch. This court...
Isn't this the kind of thing that the executive branch does all the time, say parole?
It's different than parole because of the presumptive release date. A person that is sentenced by a judge in a court under Article 4 of the judicial powers believes that the presumption for release applies to them, and they have an expectation that that judge's sentence, given at the time that they received it and walked out the door, is going to be the minimum sentence. And the only way that that can be extended is if the executive branch usurps the powers of the court and makes the rule, becomes the prosecutor, the jury, and the sentencing
judge.
How is
that different than, I mean, practically than what the parole board does all the time?
Because the expectation when you get an indefinite sentence, as you would pre-Senate Bill 2, the expectation is, say you had a sentence of 10 to 25. The expectation is you're going to serve 25 years in prison unless the grace of the parole board allows you to go back to the community before then. But that prisoner is substantially different.
So we could just get rid of the presumption of release, and that would make it constitutional?
As far as the separation of powers doctrine is concerned, that would make it constitutional for that purpose. But that, to do that, doesn't give justice to what the General Assembly was trying to do with Senate Bill 201 indefinite sentencing scheme. They weren't saying we want an indefinite sentence for all F1s and F2s and go back to parole, and they could have said that if that's what they wanted. They didn't. They said, here's what we want to do, because we have these competing issues, right? We have overcrowding
in the prison. Well, I guess what I don't understand, I understand what they wanted to do, but what I don't understand is that what you're telling me is if they had instead of saying that if your sentence is 12 to 18, instead of saying that you have a presumption of release at 12, you could serve up to 18 years. If they had just said you have a sentence of 12 to 18 years, that would be fine. And there's no problem here. And your argument seems to be that because the legislature went a little further than that and said, no, we're going to give you a presumption, defendant, that you're going to be released at 12. So then that presumption makes it unconstitutional?
It does, because the separation of powers.
So something that's good for the defendant, that gives the defendant a better chance of being released early, makes the law unconstitutional.
In this case, yes. That's exactly what it does. Because the separation of powers doctrine protects the liberty of all people. And it has to be applied in all situations, even when sometimes it might look like what I'm saying is not a compassionate thing to say. And Justice Scalia said that same exact thing regarding the Sixth Amendment argument in Oregon v. ICE, where he said, the Sixth Amendment doesn't care about compassion, doesn't care about if it's being lenient. What it cares about is this rule followed? And that's what we have to look at here. We can't think about usurping the Constitution because it might be friendly to somebody.
So you're saying in your argument here for the separation of powers that we should find that it unconstitutional based on that, even though it will also take away DRC's ability to have someone released before their presumptive minimum?
Well, what I would argue is that what you should do is do a complete reset and strike Senate Bill 201's indefinite sentencing scheme entirely. And if the legislature wants to go back to parole, that would give them an opportunity to do that. And it would also, and I'd ask you to send Mr. Hacker's case back to the trial court for resentencing de novo entirely.
Okay, but what if the General Assembly does not, if there is no appetite to get rid of indefinite sentencing, is there a way that this new amendment to the sentencing package allows for indefinite sentencing, allows for the presumption of serving that minimum time, and can that still be preserved, but have some way to draw the distinction between two people convicted of, let's say, similar crimes, given the same sentence? One does his or her time well, responds to rehabilitation, and one just creates problem after problem after problem while incarcerated. Recognizing, of course, that if you commit a crime while incarcerated, you can still be prosecuted for that crime, and that's a separate issue. But if you've got two people similarly sentenced, one does better than the other, should they still, and one seems to pose more of a threat to the public when getting out, should those two defendants or offenders be treated the same and both be released during their minimum presumptive term?
In order to, if the General Assembly wanted a presumption for a minimum release, but they still wanted to preserve the effect of this, just don't delegate that to the executive branch. Send it back to the trial court and allow the trial court to make those considerations and determinations.
Well, what's the process now with DRC? If DRC decides offender number two disobeys the rules, is causing problems, is threatening to staff, What's the mechanism by which DRC can extend the time past the minimum?
Well, that's part of the problem, is there's a procedural due process issue with this statute. So the mechanism now doesn't afford for those minimum procedural due process rights. So there's no notice provision for defendants in 2967.271E. So even if you were to try to talk about the process, about what it would be. It hasn't played out enough for me to be able to answer that.
But doesn't the statute say what happens? There's notice, there's hearing?
It doesn't say, it says there's notice and there's a hearing, but it doesn't say when the hearing might be, how long is the notice, what kind of rights does it vest in the defendant. So you have to remember that in Senate Bill 201, we're not talking about what's happening today for many people. If it's an F1, it's 3 to 11 plus half that time. So there's no provision in the statute that says we're going to look at your conduct within the last year. It's from the whole time you've been there. So it could be any of those factors, and there's no provisions because discipline is not ordinarily the standard for release. There are no provisions for what does the Department of Corrections have to do to maintain records so that a person maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later might need to defend themselves against an allegation of a discipline violation, in some cases a decade before. So there are all kinds of problems with Senate Bill 201 as it relates to defendants and their rights and maintaining them so that we can come to what a due process in the Constitution looks at, which is fairness in proceedings, and then also notice an opportunity, a meaningful opportunity to be heard in a timely manner.
Aren't all those things you're talking about as far as due process, aren't those all reasons that the due process challenge isn't ripe now? I mean, you keep saying we don't know what they're going to do.
No, because why?
We don't know what notice is.
That's why it's a facial challenge, Your Honor, because...
Well, a facial challenge, that means that you have to show that no person will receive due process protection, right? You have to show that it's unconstitutional in all applications.
And if you read the statute, it is unconstitutional in all applications.
How is that possible when you just said we don't know what kind of notice they're going to get? We don't know these things
because the statute doesn't provide for it. So as a practical matter, who knows how that's going to play out. That's not the standard, right?
That for a procedural due process standard, that everything has to be laid out in the statute. The standard is whether or not someone receives procedural due process.
Well, this particular statute, the plain meaning of it, doesn't give notice to a defendant under 2967.271E.
But what if the defendant gets notice? What if the prison institutes policies that give the defendant notice?
If the defendant were to get all of the notice in the of the due process procedures, but it isn't in the statute, and you have to go back to some DRC regulation that's subject to change willy-nilly, then it still doesn't meet the standard.
What possible authority do you have for that? That if every due process thing is not outlined in statute, that there is a facial procedural due process violation? Is there any case anywhere that's ever said that?
No, Your Honor, but if you look at State v. Guyton, the dissent in that case lays out a strong argument of why this statute is completely devoid of procedural due process.
You're into your rebuttal, and Mr. Hartman.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay. You can take 2 minutes.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Chief Justice Kennedy. Plan to just concentrate briefly on the why we have the due process concerns at all, both substantive and procedural. And that's because we have a set of rules and procedures that are designed for prison discipline, which necessarily have almost no oversight, which the judiciary is extraordinarily deferential to, and which are designed to keep people safe in prison, and we're turning them into a sentencing code. The standards in Senate Bill 201 are so vague as to be meaningless to say that any violation that compromises the security or safety of the institution. Well, literally, someone showing up 5 minutes early to lunchtime could very arguably be an effect, hurt prison security. Say, well, we don't have people there to monitor.
But why wouldn't that be a good case if that happens, instead of a reason to say that this statute is facially unconstitutional, meaning that it cannot constitutionally be applied to anyone under procedural due process.
Well, then I would, partly because I don't see an effective remedy after the fact. If I filed a declaratory judgment, I assume my friends on the other side would say, no, you can't use that for release decisions. If I filed a writ, I would expect them to say, this is a discretionary decision which you can't control during a writ.
That's a question for another day, but that doesn't transform something that's not now a procedural violation into one that is, does it?
Well, if they say it has to come at a later date, there has to be something there. So if this court decides to do that, my office would very strongly request that the court give some guidance as to what that might be, so we don't spend years of them telling me, no, you should have filed X, then we file X, and they say, no, you should, this is discretionary, and you can't get relief here. You have to show that there's some way, some effective mechanism where we can actually bring this. And right now, I don't see any, and I don't remember my friends on the other side conceding that there was an effective remedy after the fact if there were such violations.
And if we're concerned about looking for particular situations where due process hasn't been met, aren't we moving into an as-applied rather than a facial challenge?
Right, yes, and that's what I took Justice DeWine's question to ask. What if we did this as an as-applied as opposed to facial? And my response is I don't see any viable mechanism other than the initial direct appeal to make that challenge, where you could present that argument and have it heard and decided on the merits.
Yes, procedural due process is a guarantee. So there's got to be some case law out there that says when it's not present in a law that there might be a problem.
I would hope that there would be, but I also want to point out that we don't know many times once these things become ripe, if it's a violation of that they use from 5 years before where all the evidence is gone and they say, well, what you showing up 5 minutes late to lunch 5 years ago is what's going to trigger this law. There's no way the evidence is gone. In the initial challenge, they had almost no right to challenge that. They have no right to force evidence, to compel evidence, almost the entire procedure to challenge that initial ticket is discretionary on the part of DRC.
Why couldn't someone, if someone's being held, I assume you could file a habeas action?
Well, habeas only is if you show entitlement to immediate release. And my experience with filing writs is that that unless you can actually show I get out the door absolutely as a result of this, that the writ doesn't lie, at least in state habeas. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, good morning.
Thank you. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. The challenged provisions of the Regan-Tokes Act represent little more than a return to the indeterminate sentencing system that existed in Ohio prior to 1996. There were no constitutional problems with the system that existed then, and there are no constitutional problems with the system that exists now.
Counsel, is it really the same? Back then they had a parole board. There wasn't a presumption as contained in here. Someone was given a 5 to 25, and they weren't given an assurance that they would get out in five. They, for all they knew, they were going to do the whole 25 years unless they behaved.
And that actually is the first point I would like to make, which is the presumption doesn't change anything. I'd like to give you two examples why. One, an example from Ohio, and one, an example from U.S. Supreme Court precedent. I'll begin with the Ohio example, because even in the pre-1996 era, you had an entitlement to what was called good time, and it was a statutory entitlement. And the statute, you can find it Appendix 77 through 79, that we filed. And there you did have a statutory entitlement to that good time. And so, yes, you didn't have the presumption phrased the way this presumption is phrased, but there was still a presumption of earlier release based on the running of that good time. And what's significant about the good time statute is in Bray, the decision that they rely most heavily on for their separation of powers analysis, Bray distinguished bad time from good time, indicated that good time would be acceptable, and that makes this case more like Woods v. Telb than it does like Bray. Now, I promised you a second example, which is from the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Greenholz, and that was a Nebraska case involved a Nebraska statute that said an offender shall be released at the expiration of the minimum time unless the Nebraska Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections maintained custody for a variety of reasons, one of which happened to be violations of prison rules and discipline. So it didn't say a presumption in the exact same language, but that shall be released language did create a presumption. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a due process analysis, didn't find anything problematic about that phrasing. And so I think both of those examples show.
Well, let me ask you this. From my days on the trial court, the only memory I have of the legislature tell me or the use of the word presumption was in when I was sentencing. F1s and F2s had a presumption in favor of incarceration. F4s and F5 had a presumption. This was rebuttable. And this gave trial court judges guidance with the facts. Are you aware of any other statute that gives ODRC or any other branch of the executive branch that kind of guidance in their decision making with the use of presumptions?
At least not in this context. I mean, I don't want to speak to the universe of things. There may be things, but certainly in the parole release context, I think, at least in Ohio, this is the first time that this has been phrased particularly this way. But I think it's somewhat ironic because I understand my colleagues to have conceded that a pure discretionary indeterminate sentencing system would be fine. And so the idea that the General Assembly giving some guidance that is favorable to a defendant would render the statute unconstitutional, I think, is a little odd. And I don't think it rises to the level of separation of powers. Certainly, the separation of powers question is who imposed the sentence. And this court has actually already answered that question. And it answered it in Maddox in paragraphs 15 and 16. And it said the full sentence has been imposed at the time of sentencing. And so that makes this case like Woods v. Telp. The presumption doesn't change the fact that the release decision here is just like any other parole decision, which the court in Woods recognized has been part of the executive's authority from time immemorial, and it cited the Peters case from 1885. So almost over a century of law saying executive can make these types of decisions.
Counsel, is the Sixth Amendment issue in front of us or not?
I think in this case it has been forfeited, but what I will also say, and so I think it is not properly preserved in this case, but I'd like to address it anyway for at least one reason, which is the same reasons that support finding no separation of powers problem also necessarily resolve the Sixth Amendment question, because if the trial judge is imposing the full sentence, both the minimum and the maximum, there's no separation of powers problem, and there's no Sixth Amendment problem, because the full sentence is being imposed exclusively based on facts by the fact finder found by the jury. And I think going to precedent that shows why there's no Sixth Amendment problem, the most compelling decision is the recent Haymond decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, that was a plurality opinion, and you have Justice Gorsuch, who's taking a very broad view of the Sixth Amendment right. You have Justice Breyer, whose controlling opinion takes a more narrow view. But what both of them would agree on is that when you're dealing with a parole decision, when the sentence has been imposed in a range and someone is deciding how much of that sentencing range shall be served, both Justice Gorsuch's broad opinion and Justice Breyer's narrow opinion say there is no Sixth Amendment problem. And that reaffirms what every federal court at the very least had held faced with Apprendi challenges to parole release decisions. We cite some of these cases at page 21 of our brief. And even before Haymond, every court to have considered it, at least in the federal context, I can't speak to every state court, has said there is no Apprendi problem. And one of the cases they point to, and this is where you get into the overlap with the due process analysis, is the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Morrissey. And Morrissey deals with the processes that are due in a parole revocation, someone who's been released from prison is being returned. But before getting to that, Morrissey draws a bright line and says parole is not part of a criminal prosecution. The criminal prosecution has ceased, the sentence has been imposed, and so when you get to questions of when are you being, how much time are you serving on your sentence? That's a separate question than a Sixth Amendment question. And so that sort of ties in the jury trial and the Sixth Amendment points. And I'd like to then touch on sort of the due process challenge, because I think there's at least three points I would like to make.
And once you do that, why don't you, Mr. Hardwick says that, if we don't deal with due process now, that no one will ever have a chance to raise these, which I'm not sure that's a reason for us to decide something that's not properly before us. But I am curious, what is the avenue? How would someone be able to raise a claim?
I think I'll give you at least one example, and that's mandamus. And this court just last year heard a case where a party had been, they were arguing they'd been denied due process in their parole revocation hearing, and they brought a mandamus seeking to compel a new hearing. And so we think certainly if someone has received one of these maintenance of custody hearings under the statute, and they think that the due process requirements have not been followed, then they can bring a mandamus to the court, and the court can say, go back, hold another hearing that does comport with due process.
So you're essentially saying that it's just a given in the statute that due process has to be provided in this process of determining what will be the out date for a person under the Reagan-Tokes Law sentencing scheme.
I think so, Your Honor, and that's where I wanted to touch on the U.S. Supreme Court precedent that I think compels that and shows why it doesn't have to be in statute. So there's a trio of U.S. Supreme Court decisions that I think are relevant, potentially relevant here. There is Morrissey, which I already mentioned, which deals with the due process that is due when you're out of prison or being sent back. There is Wolf, which is sort of the middle, and it dealt with an entitlement to certain good time reductions and the process. You're still in prison, but the process that's due if those are going to be taken away. And then you have Greenholz, which is a traditional parole decision that involved the Nebraska statute I mentioned earlier. And I think Greenholz is the most applicable, but in the hypothetical mandamus situation, an offender could raise the challenge. They could say, I was due the process under Wolf, I didn't receive it. I was due the process under Greenholz, I didn't receive it. And this court could then say, is the process that you received consistent with what the US Supreme Court has required to be provided in this type of situation?
So potentially, if we say that if there are three arguments here, the last one being due process, if we say that due process is inherent in this scheme, then we'll be potentially facing a lot of original actions from prisoners saying they're not getting due process on their disciplinary proceedings, which could go to when they get out of prison, correct?
So I think there's a separate question for the disciplinary proceedings and the maintenance of custody hearings that are provided for by this statute. And so I think what you would definitely, certainly as it begins, you would see people trying to bring those claims. It's certainly my opinion that the process provided for by the DRC, and you can find this, I believe, at Appendix 9, comports with due process. So prisoners may file the mandamus challenges, but I don't think there's any merit because it's, in my opinion, the DRC, as long as it follows the process it set forth, does comply with the U.S. Supreme Court precedent. But that precedent shows why the facial challenge is inappropriate, because due process exists independent of any statutory requirements. And so I know there was some discussion of, well, the statute doesn't provide for notice to the offender. And that's because the due process clause independently requires notice. The statute that my colleagues have challenged and have argued about, that really is an additive process. It's providing notice to individuals that would not otherwise receive notice under the due process clause. It's not saying offenders don't get notice. I think Wolf and Greenholz, they both require notice. And so whether the statute provides for notice or not, they have to be provided under the due process clause and under U.S. Supreme Court precedent. And if the DRC failed to follow its policies and did not give a sufficient notice, then yes, the court may see a mandamus claim, and the remedy would be provide the appropriate notice, send it back, hold a hearing. I also like to touch on a separate due process, because I understand that there to be a separate vagueness due process question. And there's at least two problems with that. One, the vagueness doctrine doesn't even apply in this context, and two, there is sufficient notice of what offenders can and can't do while they're in prison. I'll begin with why it doesn't apply. Beckles v. United States said that the vagueness doctrine, as we understand it, applies to the definition of offenses. It doesn't apply to the exercise of discretion. That involved the sentencing guidelines. It involved the term crime of violence, which in the definition of a crime, the U.S. Supreme Court had already held was improperly vague. But they said it's not improperly vague when it comes to a discretionary factor with respect to sentencing. And so here, where the relevant question is whether an offender has been rehabilitated or is a threat to safety. It's not, as my colleague suggested, whether there was a problem with prison security. The statute says if you've not been if you've committed an offense while in prison, if you violated the rules, and that shows that you are not rehabilitated or a threat to safety. And those two terms, the vagueness doctrine doesn't even apply under Beckles. And the question about what conduct you can and cannot engage in prison, well, that's clearly outlined in prison guidelines and in the administrative code in 512906. That's an administrative code that lays out inmate rules of conduct. And so there's no due process problem on this vagueness point either.
Counsel, could there be an instance where you could be sanctioned for both violation of prison rules and get whatever sanction there, and that sanction also extends your time beyond your presumptive release?
If you have a disciplinary hearing, then you could be subject to your change in your level of security or your housing or those types of things, but it would be only at the maintenance of custody hearing that's provided for by the Reagan-Tokes Act that would actually cause you to spend additional time in prison. And what also you can't do under the statute is if you are prosecuted for an offense that occurs while in prison, the statute carves that out, and that is not a basis to maintain custody. You are punished separately for that under the plain language of the statute.
But wouldn't this be functionally similar to a situation of judicial release? So the trial judge is considering judicial release, brings the prisoner back, looks at the institutional report. How is this institutional report under the Reagan-Tokes law going to be fundamentally different from what a judge looks at on judicial release, which is essentially totally up to the discretion of the institution?
So the judicial release, at least for now, judicial release still exists.
Yes, I know, and I know they're completely different, and but I'm saying when you look at the process that's likely to play out for release, I know there's a hearing. I don't see anything that will be functionally different, at least in the law, from the write-up that a judge would get when they're considering whether or not to let someone out of prison on judicial release.
I think that there would be many similarities. I think the whether there is or is not a violation of prison rules would be the same, and the questions about whether you've been rehabilitated would be the same considerations. I see my time has expired. We would ask the court to affirm and to hold that there is no separation of powers, Sixth Amendment, or due process problem with the statute. Thank you.
Bad time under Bray is indistinguishable from Senate Bill 201 and indefinite sentencing scheme. Both of those statutes require the sentencing judge to determine the sentence that he thought the defendant should have, barring any aggravating circumstances, while the defendant was in prison. In both statutes, the original sentence contemplates the extension of imprisonment for bad conduct. The facts and the law under Senate Bill 201 most closely represents what happened in State X Rel Bray, and I'd ask that this court would follow that precedent and find Senate Bill 201's indefinite sentencing scheme is unconstitutional.
Counsel, your friends on the other side distinguish Bray by saying it's different in that scenario because they're extending beyond the sentence that was originally received, right?
And that extension beyond the a sentence that was originally received is exactly the same as Senate Bill 201, because what the judge gave them, the sentence the judge gave them, that promise of liberty, it is vests at the presumptive minimum release date. So that is why it's most closely like bad time, because it does extend it past the sentence the judge gave you. Thank you.
We will take it under advisement, and we will issue a decision.